Gentlemen, the case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Massachusetts against Shepherd. Smith, I think you may proceed when you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, this case presents the question whether the Fourth Amendment to the United States Constitution requires application of the exclusionary rule to evidence seized by police acting under the authority of a search warrant issued upon a finding of probable cause, but which is later invalidated because of the technical error of omission committed by the issuing judge, an error of which the police had no knowledge, took no advantage, and which resulted in no prejudice to the defendant. The Supreme Judicial Court of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts ruled that suppression was required because this court had not yet recognized an exception to application of the exclusionary rule for an error of this type. The court thus overruled the trial court's determination that although the warrant was defective, the issuing judge failing to restate in the warrant the items specified in the application or to incorporate that affidavit by reference, he declined to exclude the evidence, finding that the police had acted properly in conducting their duties, that they had acted upon probable cause and in good faith, thus presenting a factual situation in which the exclusion would have no deterrent effect. Rather, the sole consequence of exclusion would be to deprive the jury of the real and probative evidence, thus impairing their fact-finding function. I think the factual situation in this case is extremely important, and I will therefore elaborate on it in some detail. At 5 a.m. the morning of May 5, 1979, a Saturday morning, the badly burned, partially clad body of a young woman was found in a vacant lot in the Roxbury District of Boston. A piece of wire was bound around one leg. An autopsy disclosed that the victim had died of multiple skull fractures. The victim had been alive but unconscious when her body was set on fire. By midday, the victim had been identified, and Osborne Shepherd had been identified as a possible boyfriend. An officer who knew Shepherd as a gambler began to circulate through the Roxbury area, stopping at a gaming house he knew Shepherd to frequent. Shepherd himself opened the door and, after some conversation with the police, agreed to accompany them to the police station. He was given his Miranda rights in the car on the way to the station. He was told that the police were investigating the death of Sandra Bolwar, and they wanted to examine his relationship with Ms. Bolwar and establish his whereabouts on May 4th and 5th. Mr. Shepherd told the police that he had visited with the victim at her home on Tuesday, May 1st, that they together had taken a taxi cab back to his home, stopping on the way to purchase some marijuana and a bottle of amaretto. He said that the victim had left him at approximately 2 p.m. on Tuesday. He also stated that he had been at the gaming house where the police had found him from 9 p.m. on Friday until 5 a.m. that Saturday morning. After naming some other individuals who had been at the gaming house with him, he left the police station. Continuing their investigation that afternoon, the police questioned the other members of the gaming establishment, who said that indeed Osborne Shepherd had left. He had left at approximately 3 a.m. to drive, borrowing a car, to drive some men home on a trip that ordinarily took 15 minutes, although he did not return until 4:45 a.m. and then abruptly left again. The police also learned that on leaving the gaming house at 6 a.m., one of the occupants noticed on the porch a gasoline can and a pair of gloves. On Sunday morning, the police learned from a friend of Shepherd's that he had refinished his basement area, and this was an area in which he entertained women for social purposes. Most importantly, on that Sunday morning, the owner of the automobile corroborated the fact that Shepherd had borrowed his car. On inspection of the car, a police and a police chemist found human blood stains and pieces of hair on the rear bumper near the trunk area. In the trunk area, they found more human blood stains and pieces of wire similar to that which had been found on the body. The owner of the car told them that there was no wire and no blood in the trunk of that car on Friday night before he had loaned it to Shepherd. It was then, after consultation with the district attorney's office, determined that arrest and search warrants should be obtained. A Detective O'Malley typed an affidavit in support of the application for the search warrant, demonstrating probable cause for the search and the seizure. He specifically enumerated in his application, describing the condition of the body, that it had been beaten and burned, that Shepherd had been the last person known to have seen the victim, that he and the victim had gone to 42 Deckard Street, that Shepherd had been in possession of a particular automobile which was found to have blood stains and human hair on it that had not been there prior to Shepherd's using the car. He reiterated that a friend had told them that Shepherd used his basement area for entertaining women, and now Maui therefore specified the areas to be searched as the second floor and cellar area controlled by Shepherd at 42 Deckard Street. He specified the items to be seized. Probable cause for the seizure of each item was related to the facts as set out in the affidavit. The items included the fifth of amaretto, two nickel bags of marijuana, the possessions of Sandra Bolwar, wire matching that found on the body or in the trunk of the car, men's or women's clothing having blood or gasoline stains, blunt instruments which may have been used to inflict the multiple fractures, and items with the victim's fingerprints. It was then Sunday afternoon, and O'Malley was unable to find a proper warrant form. The Roxbury court was closed. Efforts to contact the clerks were unsuccessful. Efforts to find a proper warrant form at other police stations was also unsuccessful. O'Malley did find a warrant form used by the Dorchester District Court for searches for controlled substances, which he attempted to adapt. He crossed out the words controlled substances on the face of the warrant form, and he changed the name Roxbury, substituted the name Roxbury for Dorchester as the court. And he inserted a reference to 42 Deckard Street, second floor and basement as the places to be searched. He did not, at that time, delete the reference to controlled substance in the portion of the form constituting the application, which when signed would constitute the warrant itself. The trial court found, and I think it's important to note, that all of the items listed in the affidavit were small and susceptible of easy destruction and transport, and were located in a place to which the defendant had total right of access. The defendant was at liberty, and he was known to spend his evenings with the occupants of the gaming house that had given the information about the car. Therefore, it was essential that the police move with great dispatch, and they did. Arrangements were made to meet with a judge at his home. O'Malley, accompanied by other investigating officers and an assistant district attorney, went there at approximately 2:45 p.m. The judge took O'Malley's oath and signed the affidavit to that effect. The trial judge found as fact that the judge had concluded upon the affidavit that probable cause existed to search the premises and for the items listed.
Listed where? In the affidavit?
In the affidavit. O'Malley explained the problem to the judge about the warrant form that he had. He showed the judge the controlled substance form, and the judge then attempted to search his library for a proper form. He was unable to find one, and he took the form from O'Malley, assuring him that he would make the necessary changes. And he did make some minor alterations as to the name of the judicial district and the judge.
Was this person a real judge?
Yes, he was a real judge in Massachusetts.
Ms. Smith, What is the rule with respect to the action of a judicial officer? That is, the general rule is that the action of a judicial officer is presumptively valid and binding until it's set aside by some higher authority.
That is the position
Massachusetts. So when this warrant was served, executed, it had the benefit of the presumption of validity.
Yes, Your Honor.
Ms. Smith, what would have been, if they'd been successful, the real form?
We wouldn't be here.
Well, what's the difference between it and the one they used?
The real form, the proper form, has a space in which you fill in the items listed in the affidavit or make a simple notation, see affidavit incorporated or attached herein, and then staple the affidavit to the form.
And is that the only distinction between the form actually used and...
The form used here has printed in reference to controlled substances in the aspect of the form that constitutes...
In the body of the warrant, those items were not listed. The items to be searched for and seized.
That's right.
Nor was the affidavit attached to the...
The affidavit was not attached. The only correlation between the warrant that we have is in the affidavit, marijuana was named. Marijuana is a controlled substance.
So the warrant really was defective?
Yes.
As far as
the items, reflecting the specific items specified in the affidavit.
If you presented it to the owner of the premises to be searched, and he said, what are you searching for, you could not tell that from the examination of the warrant itself.
Officer O'Malley could tell that because he is the one who applied for it and specified the items to be searched.
But the owner of the premises presumably could not tell what items a search had been authorized for.
That's right. They could only tell that a search had been authorized for controlled substances, and therefore the only areas could be searched are areas that could accommodate controlled substances. And it was limited to...
Isn't it correct that when they executed the warrant, they had the affidavit with them?
Yes, they did.
So they could have showed them the affidavit, which
Absolutely.
Would then have given them a bill of particulars.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
But if I understand it, Ms. Smith, all that the judge had to do was simply, in that space that said controlled substances, was strike it out and put in, see attached affidavit?
That's right. That's all he had to do.
So it made a perfect warrant.
That would have made a perfect warrant. But as the court found, through inadvertence, total inadvertence, the judge failed to do that in the rush of the
procedure.
He was a
real judge.
He was a judge.
He was too detached to judge
at this particular point, but pardon me, Your Honor.
I was just going to observe he wasn't a member of this court.
No, Your Honor. The trial judge, he returned the warrant and the affidavit to O'Malley, informing him, as found by the trial judge, that he had the authority to carry out the search as requested. The search was then executed under the direction of O'Malley. It was limited, in fact, to what O'Malley understood the warrant to permit. In the bedroom area, a bloodstone boot was seized. In the cellar area, a bloodstone scatter rug, pieces of bloodstained cement, women's earrings, women's leotards, bloodstained jockey shorts, a hairpiece that was later identified as being very similar to one worn by the victim were found, as well as the pieces of wire similar to those found on the body and in the trunk of the car. After the search was completed, O'Malley inventoried the items, and a return was made to the Roxbury District Court on Monday morning. It seems clear to us that the police fully complied under urgent circumstances with the warrant process. However, the judge issuing the warrant, through error and inadvertence, as found by the trial court judge, failed to restate in the warrant the items specified or to incorporate the affidavit by reference.
Ms. Smith, do the police have an obligation to execute the warrant as it's written?
I believe they do, Your Honor. I believe that once that warrant
That is, in a sense, some kind of an error that occurred when the police didn't read it and say, look, that isn't what's listed in the warrant now.
Your Honor,
I guess if the police had read it at the time, the magistrate or judge could have corrected it.
Yes, he might have, but I don't think there's any obligation.
Well, there's no doubt that he would have, is there?
I would hope that he would have. I mean, I think once this was brought to his attention, he would see the mistake that it was made and correct it.
If you're a policeman, the chance there you may feel, who am I to tell the judge
Absolutely.
What form of warranty?
Right. And the police knew what they had asked for. They were assured that they got what they asked for. And they left with both the affidavit and the warrant. And I think that the police have no obligation to do anything further than secure the warrant. I think the constitutional obligation stops there. In the general case, there is simply nothing more they can do.
Well, you think the police have no obligation whatever to comply with what's written on the face of the warrant?
I'm not saying that, Your Honor. I'm saying in this case, they didn't read the warrant. They knew exactly what they needed to get. They were moving quickly before this evidence was destroyed. They did not read the warrant.
Massachusetts is that the warrant is presumptively valid once signed, then it is valid on the instant it was served.
That's right. And I think since the warrant is presumptively valid, there really is no obligation on the police to, in a sense, second guess or judge the judge.
But Ms. Smith, it's presumptively valid to seize what the warrant says may be seized, isn't it? Well, then how can it? But is it presumptively valid to seize something that's not listed in the warrant?
Not once that is determined after the fact. But the police don't wait until another court has reviewed the warrant. They have the warrant as issued by the judge. And
this warrant did not authorize them to seize the matters listed in the
affidavit. That's why it's defective.
But they thought it did.
They thought it did, absolutely. There can be no question of that. They were very specific in their affidavit. And that's why we submit.
Did they show the person the affidavit?
No, they did not. They didn't show the person either the warrant or the affidavit. They didn't ask to see it.
Well, what weight does that have?
I don't think it really has any weight. I think what we have here is a case in which the police, from any objective analysis, acted in reasonable, good faith reliance upon a judicially issued warrant.
Isn't one of the base reasons for the affidavit is to show somebody authority? Isn't that one of the purposes?
Yes, and they had authority to enter these premises.
But what authority did they have? The affidavit?
The authority in the warrant placed them on the premises.
Well, weren't they obliged to show the warrant?
If someone had asked to see it, I do not believe there's any obligation that they go in holding the warrant out. They say, we have a warrant, we're here to search this particular area. And the mother and, I believe, sister who were present had
they
no problem.
Were armed. The policemen were armed.
I'm sorry.
The policemen had weapons.
I would imagine police officers
That's
would
right.
not go on a search without a weapon. Did they have drawn weapons? I'd say no.
Well, could they be admitted because of the weapon or because of the warrant? How do you know which one?
Well, there's absolutely nothing in the record to support
That's
any
right.
even speculation that they were admitted because they were waving weapons at the people. They went peacefully. They have a warrant.
I mean, they show it.
They may have said, we have a warrant, which in fact is true, and that was enough for the people on the premises. There was no question raised by the people on the premises. There were no threats. There was no
they
need of threats.
They had a presumptively valid warrant. They didn't say that, did they?
Did the police say they have a presumptively valid warrant? No, I would doubt that.
No, they said we have a warrant.
We have a warrant, which they had, which was later determined to be defective. Found defective because of the omission by the issuing judge.
Is there any requirement by statute? Under Massachusetts law, that the officer show the warrant without a request?
Not that I know of, Your Honor.
What would be the normal practice?
I think normal practice would be for the police to go on the premises, say we have a warrant to search the particular area. If a request is made, I want to see the warrant, then they should show the warrant. There was no request made.
But they do not, under the Massachusetts law, they're not required to deliver the warrant or a copy of it.
No, I do not believe so.
Or to show.
No.
Ms. Smith, there's no question, I guess, that the police were acting with subjective good faith here. Is it fair to say that a policeman acts with objective good faith in executing a warrant to seize items not mentioned on the face of the warrant? Do you think that that generally would amount to objective good faith?
I think it would be, I can't give you an absolute blanket answer to a question like that, Your Honor. I think it would be limited to an examination of the totality of all the circumstances surrounding the officers obtaining and executing the warrant. I think in this instance, under an objective test, the officers acted in a reasonable manner in executing the warrant they had obtained. They established probable cause. They listed the items specifically in their affidavit. They presented them to a neutral and detached magistrate who made a determination that probable cause existed to seize those particular items. He took the warrant. He told them that he would adopt it. The trial judge found that he told them they had the authority to do what they had requested. Gave them back the warrant, he gave them back the affidavit. I think under the circumstances, the fact the police didn't read the warrant, it doesn't render their conduct objectively unreasonable.
May I ask, when they got that warrant,
there was nothing more they can do.
May I ask you a question here? May I, for the moment, just put the exclusionary rule to one side and assume we've got a warrant that's defective for the reasons that we've talked about. In your opinion, did the police officers conduct an unreasonable search within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment?
In my opinion, if and only if this court were to extend its holding in Gates, where the court announced a totality of the circumstances test for determining the probable cause aspect, if you were to extend that to determining the reasonableness of a search in this instance, I think, yes, we would have a reasonable search because the police complied with the warrant process. The police executed the search consistent with what the authority they told they had. There were exigent circumstances. This was easily destroyed evidence. The defendant was going to understand very, very shortly that his alibi had been, in effect, blown out of the water, that he had been identified with a car with human blood on it practically simultaneously with the body being deposited and burnt in the vacant lot. And I think, yes, indeed.
But of course, if you're right on that, that there's a reasonable search here, then there's no need to reach a good faith exception to the exclusionary rule.
If the court is going to extend Gates, consider it under a warrantless
search. Well, Gates really dealt with what kind of showing of probable cause is necessary.
That's right.
Here there's admittedly probable cause, but and there's also admittedly a defect in the warrant.
Absolutely.
I mean, the ultimate holding in Gates was that the warrant was okay.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So it's a little bit different.
It is different. Yeah. That's why I can't say that without the court extending Gates to fit this type of situation, that this would be necessarily a reasonable search without the warrant.
Well, I didn't necessarily mean to say without the warrant would it be. I'm just saying taking all the facts together, would you say this is a reasonable or an unreasonable search?
Exactly, Your Honor. Taking all the facts together, including the existence of the warrant under the totality of the circumstances, I'd say it was a reasonable search. However, in a case when we are talking here about the application of the exclusionary rule, in a case in which there was no police misconduct, no deterrent effect can be achieved by application of the exclusionary rule. And I think it is also inappropriate to extend the deterrent rationale to judicial mistakes, given that a judge is not a proponent of either side. He is not a member of the law enforcement team. I would suggest that appellate determination or identification of the judicial error is sufficient to deter future conduct.
In
answering Justice Stevens, I suppose if you just said any time an officer makes a reasonable mistake, there's no violation of the Fourth Amendment because it's a reasonable search. Well, you really arrive at the same result.
We would.
Except that then you hold that there's been no violation of the Fourth Amendment at all.
Well, the Fourth Amendment only precludes unreasonable searches. So if the search is found to be reasonable, with or without a warrant.
Well, but usually searching a house, you need a warrant.
I believe all of the case law says that ordinarily, except if you can establish a specific exception, a warrant is required for the search of a home, which is why I've focused on the application of the exclusionary rule to this type of reasonable mistake.
So you would be saying any time it's reasonable for an officer to believe that he's complied with the warrant requirement, that there's no violation of the Fourth Amendment? But that was your submission to Justice Stevens. This was a reasonable search. The officers reasonably believed they had a good warrant.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because they had the affidavit.
They had the affidavit. They'd gone through the whole warrant process. The only trouble was that the
two pieces of paper weren't clipped together.
That's the size of the whole error in this case. And that is one reason that we would argue that the exclusionary rule should not apply, because it's totally contrary to the idea of proportionality, which I think is central to our concept of justice. It deflects the truth-finding process and affords a windfall to, in this case, a guilty defendant of outrageous proportions. It's a remedy that is simply not consistent with the degree, the extent, or the effect of the error committed in this case. Commonwealth, therefore, requests this court to recognize an exception to application of the exclusionary rule where the police act in reasonably based good faith, not merely subjective good faith at all, in obtaining a warrant. Such an exception is submitted is not inconsistent with the concerns which gave rise to the exclusionary rule in the first instance, for it would have no effect on the dispositions of those cases involving warrantless rummaging through a person's belongings or other flagrant violations, as were the case in Weeks and Maps. Nor would it permit police falsification of the facts supporting a finding of probable cause, because by definition, that would not be reasonable good faith. It would simply be an explicit recognition that exclusion of evidence at the expense of the public, where police have complied with the warrant process in an objectively reasonable manner, simply has no legitimate justifications. The exception would not be inconsistent with prior recent rulings of this court, which have implicitly recognized that the deterrent purpose of the rule is not effectuated where the police have acted in a reasonable manner. Finally, I would suggest that the exception would serve two salutary purposes. First, the exception will serve to foster this court's stated preference for warranted searches so that a neutral and detached magistrate is interposed between the police and the individual. And second, by granting consideration to the extent and effect of the error, rather than the mere fact of the error, it will restore some degree of proportionality to our criminal justice system and acknowledge that the truth-finding function of our system will not be unreasonably impaired by inflexible, mechanistic application of the exclusionary rule. Thank you very much.
Mr. Reinstein, let me ask you a question right at the outset, if I may. Suppose this affidavit had been attached to the warrant with a clip. What would you say then? Was it... And if the warrant had said, see attached affidavit?
The key, I think, is the sufficiency of the words of incorporation, whether on the face of the warrant there is an indication by the magistrate that he or she intended to adopt the language of another document, so that if there is sufficient words of description in the warrant itself, sufficient to identify either by saying see attached and the document is attached, or C, a document and describes the document by date and author, then I believe that that would be sufficient to meet the requirements of the particularity requirement.
But without that cross-reference, the warrant would be invalid, you say?
That's right.
But do you agree with your friend that the law of Massachusetts gives presumptive validity to that warrant?
I don't agree with Ms. Smith.
It's not presumptively valid, the act of a judge?
I believe that it is clear that a police officer may not treat as presumptively valid a document which he knows...
Let's forget about the police officer. Let's forget about the police officer. Is it the law of Massachusetts that the action of a judge within the scope of his lawful authority is presumptively valid until it's set aside on review?
That's a general proposition that would be true.
So that this warrant would fall within that rule, would it not?
No, it would not.
Why not?
The police officer in this case, Detective O'Malley, who knew from the very outset what this investigation was about. He knew that it was a murder investigation, and he knew what they were looking for. He knew what he asked for in his application for a warrant.
I thought you conceded that if a clip like this or anything like it had attached the two together, it would be all right.
Not a clip alone. The proximity is not enough to make it sufficient. There has to be some indication that the magistrate who reviewed the application actually adopted its language and the scope of the search which it contemplates. I suggest that a paper clip, a staple, or some other mechanical attachment is not sufficient to do that. There have to be words of description and incorporation.
If the words were, see affidavit attached.
If the words were, see affidavit attached, and the affidavit were attached, I believe that that would be sufficient. I would like to respond at the outset to the description of some of the facts which counsel for the state has described in her presentation. The state says that there was probable cause for this search and that the search described in the application was in fact authorized by the magistrate. Because there is no proper warrant executed by the magistrate in this case, something which reflects on its face that certain findings were made by the magistrate after consideration of the facts set forth in the affidavit, we're forced to rely in this case on an after-the-fact reconstruction based on a police officer's testimony approximately 1 year later in the proceedings in the, related to the motion to suppress the evidence. And that evidence shows as follows, that the police officers with the wrong warrant form in hand went to the magistrate's home on a Sunday afternoon, that they knew of the problems with the warrant form at that time. And in fact, they told the magistrate, they said, we have the wrong form, something will have to be done about this. The magistrate looked at it, and he acknowledged that this was the wrong form. And he said that, in the police officer's words, he would adjust the warrant. And that is all that is in the record about what the magistrate told the police officers about his changes in the warrant. There's nothing in the record about telling them of what the scope of their authority was or that he would grant the full approval for the search that they had described in the application. The officers then took that warrant, and the state concedes today that it was never read. They simply put it in their pocket and went out to execute it. Now, let me mention first the question of exigent circumstances. The police obtained the final link of evidence which they put in their application for the warrant early on Sunday morning in their interview with the owner of the car where the blood was found on the trunk. And it was shortly after that time that they made a decision to arrest the defendant and to seek a warrant for the search of his home. They made no attempt at that time to locate the defendant, who was not at that point at his home. He was at the gaming house where they had found him the previous day. They went to the judge's house sometime in early to middle afternoon, still not having, as I understand it, made any attempt to find out where the defendant was. And it was only when they returned to the District 2 police station that they discovered, by asking one of the witnesses that they had interviewed that morning, where is the defendant? He made a telephone call to the gaming house and learned that he was there. So the police knew, at least from that point on, at least from the point at which they should have known of the defects in the warrant, where the defendant was, that he was not in a position to interfere with a search or to tamper with any evidence they might be seeking. With respect to the finding of probable cause, there is, of course, nothing in the warrant which reflects the finding of probable cause as to the items which were described in that application. And all that the motion judge found, the trial judge found in this case, was he found as a fact on the basis of the affidavit that the magistrate found that there was probable cause to search the second floor premises of the house at 42 Deckard Street and the playroom, which was in the basement. And that is obvious from the face of the search warrant, which does, in the application part of it, mention the premises at 42 Deckard. It says 42 Deckard, second and basement. There is a photocopy of the warrant itself, which appears on page 74A of the record appendix, which appears as an appendix to Justice Liaco's concurring opinion in the Supreme Judicial Court. With respect to the marijuana and the question of whether there was probable cause to search for marijuana, we don't concede that there was probable cause to search for marijuana. The only evidence supporting the application for the warrant on that was a statement made by the defendants on Saturday that on Tuesday, some 5 days before the warrant was executed, and 3 to 4 days before the murder took place, that the victim and the defendant had gone to his house, and before going there, they had purchased some marijuana. But the defendant also told the police, which is not reflected in this affidavit, that when the victim had left his house...
Counsel, I was just looking at the opinion of the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts at page 49, small a, in the joint appendix. And this is, I believe, Justice Wilkins, if I'm not mistaken, describing the findings of the trial court. And he says, on the matter of the search warrant, he concluded that the warrant was issued on probable cause.
The findings of the trial court are contained...
Well, was Justice Wilkins simply mistaken then in making that observation?
I think that slightly overstates the extent of the findings. And in some respects, I think the findings of the trial court go well beyond the testimony that was actually given in the Superior Court. The only evidence about what took place in the proceedings before the magistrate was the testimony of Detective O'Malley, who based it on his recollection of what had happened a year earlier. And the only statement that he says that the judge made to them was that after receiving the warrant that he would adjust it. There were no statements about findings of probable cause or comments on the substance of the application. All of the rest of the findings of both the the trial court and the conclusions of the Supreme Judicial Court are based on inferences drawn from those facts.
Because we don't ordinarily take a case to review a question of whether or not there was probable cause when the lower courts have made a finding either that there was or wasn't.
Well, in this instance, the finding of probable cause invariably is first made by the magistrate. The problem with this case is that there's nothing to reflect what the magistrate did, so that as a result, the Superior Court, the Supreme Judicial Court, and now this court are forced to rely on this after-the-fact reconstruction of what happened. And that is what's before the court.
When you're talking about probable cause, you're always talking about after-the-fact reconstruction, aren't you? When a search warrant is challenged in court, it's always after it's been executed.
But the preliminary decision is made before the fact, before the search is actually carried out by the magistrate. That's the function of the warrant requirement, to have that determination made before there is some intrusion.
But that's always ex parte, is it not?
Invariably, that is ex parte.
There's no doubt, is there really, that the magistrate, if he'd noticed the error at the time, would have corrected it and authorized the search for the items listed.
That is certainly
in the
a possibility. Certainly,
well,
if
it's much more than a possibility. You have direct evidence, do you not, that he expressed his intention to authorize the search for the scope spelled out in the affidavit?
To authorize a search, there is nothing to indicate that he intended to authorize the full search for each of the items that were specified in the affidavit.
We're not here to argue about the rule in Shelley's case or something goes back to Chitty and pleading. I mean, I think we've got more important things in mind in granting this writ, I think.
The judge looked at the affidavit?
Yes, we can assume the judge looked at the affidavit.
Then he knew, at least, what kind of a search he was authorizing.
We can assume that the judge knew generally not only what kind of a search was authorized, but what it was that the police had found thus far. He knew that it was a murder investigation.
Counsel, before you go on,
yes,
no question of prejudice to your client in this case, is there?
I believe there are several ways of looking at the prejudice. There is definite prejudice. First,
let me ask, follow up with this question. If the affidavit had been attached to the warrant in the way you suggested to the Chief Justice would be appropriate, would the search have been any more extensive or different in any respect?
I don't believe it would have.
You doubt that it would
have? I do not believe that it would have.
So in what way was that prejudice, actual prejudice?
Well,
apart from the theoretical argument that we're addressing here today, and that is whether any technical violation of the warrant procedure requires exclusion of obviously probative evidence.
I don't think that this is a technical violation.
Let me explain why. You would agree it was inadvertent, wouldn't you? No suggestion that the judge deliberately omitted.
No, I'm not suggesting
right.
that. The requirement in the Fourth Amendment that a warrant particularly describe the items to be seized serves a number of important functions. It is tied to the requirement of probable cause. The magistrate is expected to find probable cause and then to evidence that finding and to give direction to the police officers. The magistrate is expected to record that in the written warrant document. Serves several functions. First, none of which were met in this case, and that is why there was some prejudice to the defendant. First, the warrant, which was the equivalent of a warrant in blank, since it described something completely different from what was described in the affidavit. It didn't give notice to the members of the defendant's family who were home when the police came.
To look at the warrant?
The police officer testified that it was showed to them.
Did he ask? My question was, did anyone ask to see the warrant and read it?
The record doesn't show whether anyone read it. Detective O'Malley testified that when he went to the defendant's home, he was met by the defendant's sister and mother, and that he showed them the warrant. Presumably they examined it and read it. I should add that...
Well, you find facts in the findings. I didn't find any fact that they presumably read it.
There is nothing in the record which suggests that they presumably read it. The record says only that it was shown to them. That's all. Second point on the question of prejudice is that although Detective O'Malley knew what he wanted to search for, the warrant did not give specific direction to the police officers who were responsible for executing the search. And I should add that there were, I believe, 10 police officers who went to the defendant's home, some of whom went to the cellar, others went to the second floor. I believe that Detective O'Malley went to the cellar, led the group that conducted the search there, and that a number of other police officers went to the second floor and were on their own. So that while Detective O'Malley may have known what it was that he was looking for, the rest of the police officers, and to some extent Detective O'Malley, were forced in conducting this search to determine its limits by their impression, not of what was written in the warrant, but their impression of what they had asked for, what they thought they had probable cause for, and their impression of what the judge had let them do, what he had said, whether there was some clear indication that they could do such and such a search.
Mr. Reinzer, let me go back just a minute. I don't know if this has a great deal of bearing on the case, but there seem to be numerous conflicting versions of the facts. Now, I'm looking at page 28A of the record, which I believe is the trial justice's findings of fact. And on page 28A, it says, with respect to the manner in which the warrant was served, the defendant's mother and sister were present at the time. O'Malley orally informed them of the fact he had a warrant authorizing the search of the second floor premises and area occupied by the defendant. Now, I understood you to say that there was a finding that the detective showed the warrant.
The only testimony...
Didn't you say that just a minute ago?
No, I did not say there was a finding. I said that the testimony was.
Well, this finding certainly doesn't support any conclusion that the detective showed the warrant.
That's correct. The record before the court includes the full testimony that was considered by the trial judge, and I suggest that the court is not bound to accept a finding which is not based on any evidence at all, that where the sole evidence is something else, that the judge's findings is clearly erroneous and is not necessarily to be accepted by this court. There is a third reason why there is, if not prejudice to the defendant, some concern why a written warrant, should be required in every case. And that is that, as in this case, we are trying to determine, several years after this event took place, what it was that happened. The Superior Court had that problem, and now this court is going to have to determine whether there was probable cause, what the judge said, and what the effect of the judge's instructions or comments to the police may be. That raises the possibility, if that's an acceptable procedure, that in any case where a search warrant is challenged as being defective on its face, that the police officers can, and the prosecution can attempt to bring in additional evidence to go behind the warrant to show that the warrant not mean what it said, and that a search completely different than the search authorized by the warrant was in fact authorized by the magistrate who issued it.
You have been advancing the familiar arguments in favor of the strict exclusionary rule, and we've heard those before. I suppose the reasoning behind my initial question was whether, if the court responds to the request that is made in this case and in the case that follows for some relaxing of the strictness of the present exclusionary rule, it is relevant or irrelevant that the defendant in the case suffered personal prejudice. And I take it your answer is there's no evidence in this case of any such prejudice. Personal prejudice. If the search warrant had been in perfect condition, the search would have been the same.
I agree that the search warrant had been precisely as applied for,
yes,
then the search that was conducted mm-hmm. would have in fact been
right.
Failed.
And I'd make the same argument you're making for the strictness of the exclusionary rule if I had your responsibility.
There is a second consideration in dealing with the application of the exclusionary rule in this particular case. The formulation and the standards suggested by both the state and by the Solicitor General as amicus in this case and as the petitioner in the Leon case is that the conduct of police officers should be judged by a standard of what a reasonably well-trained police officer would do. A reasonably well-trained police officer under the circumstances of this case should have been expected to stop, to look at the warrant, to read it, and to say, this is not the warrant that we requested. This is a different warrant than we requested, and to go back to the magistrate and to get the correct warrant.
Here, or made a reference, not a finding, a reference to the law of Massachusetts saying a search warrant may be read with the complaint where it is attached to the warrant to provide sufficiency of the description of the place to be searched. That, I suppose, was the basis of your response that if these two pieces had been clipped together, the problem would have been solved.
That's right, so long as there was sufficient description there to incorporate it. I believe the Fourth Amendment would place some restrictions.
Absent a staple or a clip or a reference, it falls.
It is the reference which is the key point. It's the intent to incorporate.
This statement of the law of Massachusetts doesn't say anything about the reference.
No, I don't believe
it. A search warrant, said the judge, may be read with the complaint, that is here the affidavit, where it is attached to the warrant.
No. That's correct. That would be the law of Massachusetts. However,
he doesn't say it must be referred to. There must be a reciprocal reference.
I suggest that the Fourth Amendment requires some appropriate words of description so that it is the clear intent of the magistrate to adopt the language of the affidavit. Because the police officers in this case knew or should have known that the Fourth Amendment requires that a warrant describe what it is to be seized, because they were put on notice by that language, by the parallel language of the state constitution, and by a state statute, which also requires that search warrants describe what it is that's going to be seized. There is no claim in this case that they had no basis for knowing. You don't have to be a constitutional scholar. You don't need the advice of a judge or of the district attorney's office to read what is quite explicit in the Fourth Amendment.
Is there any evidence of bad faith on the part of the police officers?
The trial court made a finding of good faith, and the officers testified at several points that they believed what they were doing was proper. However, I believe the trial court's finding is clearly limited to the subjective good faith of the police officers, which we don't question.
Well, your submission then includes a suggestion that an officer is unreasonable. It would be unreasonable to think that since he had the affidavit in one hand and the warrant in the other, that he was authorized to search for the items in the affidavit.
I don't believe that that is a reasonable proposition, absent something which would, in the warrant, executed by the magistrate, which would tell him that the warrant had approved, that the magistrate had approved the search which is described in the application.
And you would think that the officer shouldn't have taken the magistrate's word for saying, I'm going to do what you ask. They had to read the warrant.
They had to read the warrant
as it was issued, and not just read the affidavit.
That's right. They had to rely on something in writing from the magistrate. And then, even if they had read it, they would have been on notice. They can't execute something which they know of their own personal knowledge is not valid. For example, if a magistrate issues an arrest warrant, which authorizes the arrest of John Doe, and the police know, either after the fact or contemporaneously, that John Doe is not the person that either they applied for or they have later information which tells them that John Doe is not guilty of the offense.
So if there's an affidavit that asks for a warrant to search a certain address and the warrant comes out and it's one number off, there's been a typographical error, officers should have picked that up.
It depends on whether the error in the warrant is in the nature of an ambiguity.
Nothing ambiguous about it. There's a difference between 17 Black Street and 18 Black Street.
If there's a 17 Black Street and an 18 Black Street, then they can't conduct the search. If there's only one house on Black Street, then the variance between the affidavit and the warrant would probably not be significant.
And if the affidavit is attached to the warrant and it says 18 and the warrant on its face says 17, they shouldn't go searching 18.
They should not conduct the search in that case. They are faced with a contradiction, and it should be resolved by the magistrate rather than by the police.
Well, there are cases against you on that, I believe, aren't there? Incorrect address in the affidavit. Where there really is a place of the...
The really underlying principle of all of the cases dealing with misdescription and ambiguity is that there has to be something which permits the officers on the scene to make a reasoned choice and to understand that the court made a finding of probable cause and granted them the authority to conduct the search. There's a choice to be made...
No, but supposing you got a case that everybody involved, from the magistrate to the officer to the executing officer on down, intended 17 Black Street to be searched. That's the place where the defendant lives and all the rest. And they type in 18 Black Street, which is next door. They go out and execute that affidavit. There are a lot of cases saying that's not a defective warrant, aren't they? It does not, in fact, authorize the search of 17, but it does, in fact, authorize the search of the place that was intended to be searched. Aren't there? Maybe I'm wrong. I thought there were such cases. I think I've read some.
There are some cases about partial misdescriptions, but where, as I understand it,
other information on the face of the warrant that makes it clear that they want.
If there's something on the face of the warrant which would either mislead or makes the police officers make a choice on the scene and leaves doubt about the intention of the magistrate, then they can't execute the warrant.
Well, Mr. Reinstein, don't you think there may be a point at which you get, I don't doubt the cases say what you say they say, but where you're getting away from kind of Fourth Amendment values that are mandated by the federal constitution and get into something that's really quite finicky, almost like the law of wills about misdescription. Do you think that's all Fourth Amendment law as well as, say, state of Massachusetts law or some other state law?
I'm glad that I'm not in a position of having to defend that entire body of law today. I don't think that the court needs to reach that issue, and I don't think that the Fourth Amendment necessarily requires pickiness. But rejection of this warrant is not being picky. This is a warrant which is just plainly defective on its face.
May I ask another question? Is any evidence in this record of a practice of police officers in this jurisdiction serving warrants that contain no specification of the items to be seized?
There is no evidence in the record yet.
And I asked you a little while ago about good faith, and you agreed that the court found, court below, the trial court, I suppose, found good faith. There's no evidence of willful omission of the items to be searched, is there?
There is nothing to indicate that the police officers deliberately used this warrant for some ulterior motive. In fact, as the state now suggests, they didn't read it.
Just one question. Is your only complaint, do you admit that if they had written on the warrant, see the attached affidavit, everything would be all right? Do you admit that?
And they had attached the affidavit.
Yeah.
So that...
And is that your only complaint?
That is the substance of the criticism of this warrant. That's correct. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted. We'll resume at 1 o'clock.